Today is Tuesday, September 17th, and this is the Joint Interim Special Committee on Public Education Appropriation. And what I'm going to have our committee staff, Victoria, kind of help us go through what our required steps are here this morning. So I think we need to adopt committee rules.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I'm sure you've all studied them and reviewed them comprehensively. Senator Haas, can I have a motion?
Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules.
There's a motion to adopt the committee rules. Any objections? So adopted. Anything else, Victoria?
We can move into the, unless you want to do introductions or something, we can move directly into the informational hearings.
Okay. This is a fine committee, and I know that everybody has been working hard. Do you want to introduce yourself for the record? Anybody? Representative Springer, why don't we just say who we are? And
I'm Representative Springer, House District 17, Sia, Lebanon, Sweet Home, up to Detroit, State and Sublimity, a whole bunch of little towns all through the canyon, and Senator Girard stole my cookie.
Okay.
That's why he has two and I have none.
Okay. And Senator Girard, do you want to introduce yourself? This is on camera.
Fred Girard, I represent rural Clackamas, Marion, and Linn counties.
Senator Haas.
Mark Haas from Washington County, Beaverton, and Alloa.
And I'm Representative Comp, and I serve House District 22, Woodburn, Jervis, Brooks, and North Salem. Thank all of you for serving on this committee, and we are a special committee, as the heading of our title states, that we only meet once, and it is our charge to review any statutory changes and previous reports on the education appropriations. So our first presenter today, I need to open a public hearing?
Informational hearing.
Okay. I'm going to open an informational hearing, and our first presenter is... Oh,
and
okay, good. Staff is going to Hannah, if you want to come forward while Victoria is joining us at the dais.
Hannah Lai from Legislative Council. Victoria asked that I come here to give an overview as to why we are here. The reason why is Section 8, Article 8 of the Oregon Constitution. It was adopted by the people in November of 2000 as a result of an initiative. Under that section, the Legislative Assembly is directed to appropriate in each biennium a sum of money sufficient to ensure that the state system of public education meets quality goals established by law, and publish a report that either demonstrates the appropriation is sufficient or identifies the reason for the insufficiency, its extent, its impact on the ability of the state system of public education to meet those goals. Big mouthful, not a whole lot of punctuation, a lot of conjunctions. Of course, I went to court. So in 2009, the Oregon Supreme Court looked at this section and made a few decisions. One is that the first part of the sentence that says the Legislative Assembly shall appropriate in each biennium a sum of money is a mandate on the Legislative Assembly to appropriate that money. The court did say that the second part, where we're looking at a report that can state that the appropriation is insufficient, meant that the legislature can't be required to give that amount of money. So in other words, a court can say, legislature, you didn't do what you were supposed to do, bad legislature, but a court can't do anything about it, as long as the legislature comes back and has a report. So for that report, there are a few statutory provisions. I had a handout, I don't know if that got to you, but one of the methods for producing that report is the Committee on Public Education Appropriation, which is you people. And so The statute sets out some of the things that you are supposed to have in your report. We also have established the Quality Education Commission, which establishes what the sufficient level of funding should be, and I know that's going to go into greater detail later. So that's about where I am. Do you want to take it, Victoria?
Sure. Victoria Cox from Committee Services. So the report has to determine whether or not K-12 funding is sufficient and determine whether or not quality goals for post-secondary education exist. Determine the extent and impact of the insufficiency. There is a possibility of using an alternative methodology, not the quality education model, but there are very specific requirements in the statute about what alternative methodologies can be used. And then, as I said, post-secondary education just have to identify whether or not there are quality goals. If there are quality goals, then a similar report is required on the post-secondary, whether or not the funding allocated was sufficient. 180 days post-signee-die is the deadline for the report, which in this case will be January 4th, actually 2014. Sorry about that. Okay, so now I'm going to kind of go through the history of the reports that have been issued so far. You will note that they are mind-numbingly familiar and similar. 21-2003 biennium was the first report. The committee found that K-12 funding was insufficient. Post-secondary was exempt. The QEM recommended $6.061 billion. Legislative appropriation was just over $5 billion, which was reduced to $4.9 billion after the 2002 special session and the failure ballot measure 28. The extent of the insufficiency for that biennium was $1.142 billion. So the 2003-2005 report, again, insufficient, post-secondary exempt. The QEM recommended $6.995 billion. The legislature appropriated $5.2 billion, which was reduced to $4.9 billion after the failure of Measure 30. The extent of the insufficiency was $2.0095 billion. 2005-2007 biennium, once again, K-12 funding insufficient, post-secondary exempt, QEM recommended 7.035, legislature appropriated 5.24, which was increased that year to 5.306 in the second year of the biennium. The extent of the insufficiency was $1.729 billion. 07-09, QEM recommended 7.766, legislature appropriated 6.245. reduced to 6.1323 due to declining forecasts, and the extent of the insufficiency was $1.6337 billion. Okay, so 2009-2011, QEM recommended 8.35, the legislature appropriated 6, which was reduced to 5.753. The extent of the insufficiency was 2.597. 2011-13, recommendation was 8.75, the appropriation was 5.71, the insufficiency was 3.04. So that gives you the history of where we have been, and that brings us to where we are now.
Okay. Any questions for our staff? Thank you. Thank you for the update. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Our next presenter, to help us understand this even a little bit more focused, it's like putting the elephant through the needle, you know, threading the needle. Doug Wilson, he's going to even this whole thing out.
Thank you, Madam Chair, member of the special committee, I guess, joint committee. Name is Doug Wilson, Legislative Fiscal Office. I'm going to zero in on the financing real briefly, mainly the K through 12, other than the first slide. The first slide just shows you for 13-15 what you passed a few months ago in terms of overall education funding. I did not try to make this look like a Pac-Man eating the rest of the budget, meaning the state school fund, but the state school fund of total education budget does represent about 77% of the total budget, and you can look at it, the other smaller shares there. Keep in mind much of the other dollars go out to other institutions, community colleges, which represents about 6%, about $450 million $1,000 exactly goes out to community colleges for the state support. And then, not surprising, OUS, the Oregon University System, all of that also flows out to the various institutions. And also keep in mind that for the Department of Education there, of that 6%, a very large share of that, over $220 million, flows out to school districts as various grants and aids. Moving on to state, or K through 12, dealing with the formula. So there's both the local share property taxes and what other sources, and then the state school fund, which is the darker blue. You can see over time the changes from 03-05 to what you appropriated at the last session in 2013. Over time, there's been changes in the mix that are pretty significant, but over this time period, the state grants, the state share of that went up about 33% from the $4.9 million in 03-05 to the $6.55 billion, in the current biennium. At the same time, the growth rate in the local share was 35% over that same period. So it grew slightly faster, but in the more recent time period, between 11-13 and 13-15, the state share grew by between 13 and 14%, while the local share grew less than 1%. So you can see that during that time period, the state share sort of went up, dropped off again during the recession, and is now recovering. If you take a look at the share of the formula funding for 13-15, the blue shaded or purple is the lottery. The blue shaded is the state general fund. And that represents the state school fund or the state appropriation in that area, which totals 67% of the total amount that's spent through the formula for K through 12. And the green shaded areas, of which the property tax and timber tax revenues make up the vast majority of that, represents about 33% of the total amount available through the formula. In contrast, I just went back and took a look at 09-11, which was, you know, sort of in the depths of the recession, in contrast, and you can see that there were a few other sources of revenues that played into the formula. The Rainy Day Fund, which is a general fund source, there were about 4% of the amount that came from federal stimulus funds, or the ARRA funds, which offset a general fund in the state budget, but it still was part of the state commitment. And then lottery funds were a larger share, I think 6% versus this current biennium's 3%. And then on top of that, you used education stabilization funds in that biennium. So you can see the changing nature of the funding just between those two biennia. Then in terms of where the money goes, in terms of that K through 12 school formula distribution, there is a statewide uses, a term I used, which represents 0.8% of that. You can see the list of various uses of those funds. There are two new uses this biennium. The first is the skilled nursing facility distribution, which is $500,000. There's no reason why that's white. Something happened in my spreadsheet. And then the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning, which is $33 million here. That is a brand new program that was House Bill 3233. And the State Land Board is meeting, I believe, this week, and will take a vote. And that amount effectively will increase by another $12 million by increasing the distribution of the Common School Fund. That was contemplated in the final days of the session and the end of session bills. And then finally, to show, well, on this graph, Then 99.2% is spread to school districts and ESDs through the formula, and there's also some more specialized grants, but these also flow to the school districts, high-cost disabilities, the facilities grants, and the equalization grants and small school district supplements. Just a note on the facilities grant, there was also a change there. Prior to 13-15, that amount was $25 million each biennium. That was reduced by statute or by a bill to $20 million per biennium. That was a set amount in statute. And then finally, just to show that there is significant other funding beyond the formula that goes through K through 12, I've sort of listed those. There's the Department of Education Operations, debt service from, I believe, earlier in like 2001, 2003, where the state used its borrowing power to provide some assistance to districts for facilities, school for the deaf and blind, or youth school for the deaf, and then youth corrections programs, and then a large amount going out as grant in aids out to school districts and ESDs and other entities that benefit in some way K through 12. What this doesn't include, these tables are the OEIB, which is about $6 million, which is partially or mainly connected to K through 12. Early learning, which is part of the Department of Education now, about $160 million, and youth development, which is roughly $10 million. You could add those if you want to talk about that P through 20 scenario on and the Department of Education. So that gives you a perspective on sort of where you stand for funding at this time. Any questions? I'd be glad to take them.
Senator Gerard.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. The question I have, Doug, is the feds are in a world of hurt even more so than the state. Are you seeing any cutbacks for the next biennium within the federal arena?
Madam Chair, Senator Gerard, I would guess there are some through sequestration. I do know there's been some discussion around the Head Start, which isn't a K through 12 program, but related. And we do get quite a bit of money for special education and compensatory education, No Child Left Behind type of funds. That will probably be affected in some way. We had not been affected to this point because of the timing significantly, but I know that is one of the things we're taking a look at and asking the agencies to come forward now to show us what the next year, federal fiscal year, will bring.
Thank you, Doug.
Yep.
Appreciate the update and the ups and downs of Oregon's economy and school funding. Mr. Cannon, Ben Cannon, tell us where our future's leading us. Do you have the crystal ball?
No, I do not, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Ben Cannon, Governor's Education Policy Advisor, asked to be here today, I think, to talk about, in general terms, the governor's perspective on outcomes-focused funding for education. So I'll speak for a couple of moments about that and how we're thinking about that. And then also to address the post-secondary portion of your charge. On outcomes funding, as you know, the governor ran for office and was elected and brought through the OEIB a perspective relative to shifting more of our education funding to be focused on outcomes. And I guess at a general level, we've thought of that in two ways and brought that work forward in a couple of different dimensions. One type of outcomes funding that some states have experimented with, I will call, and it's not a universally loved term to be sure, but I will call performance funding, where in essence institutions of education are funded at least partially on the basis of their success in hitting outcomes that the state or some entity has established. So, for example, school could be funded partially on the basis of the extent to which students are graduating, receiving diplomas, versus the sort of conventional model where most, if not all, of their funding is on a per-student basis, a weighted per-student basis. The second, and I'll come back to that in a moment, the second way in which we've generally understood this world of outcomes funding, the second type of funding that we've would generally put under that category is a sort of strategic investment approach, where grants are made by the state that are closely associated with improved student outcomes in certain key dimensions. So on the one hand, performance funding, where you're really shifting formulas to reflect some attention to student success and some payment on the basis of student success. That's outcome funding type one. Outcome funding type two, strategic grants designed to improve outcomes in targeted ways. With number one, obviously the legislature establishes the formula for funding K-12. And as a result, it would require legislative action, and it is really a legislative prerogative to establish how we, or if we were to adopt any sort of performance funding in the K-12 system. The Oregon Education Investment Board and the governor have not brought to you recommendations relative to performance funding in part in K-12, in part because of the complexity of it and the difficulty of doing that in ways that don't unintentionally penalize schools or districts and actually harm the kids who need the most help. But it is a topic that we remain interested in. The task force that the legislature created to look at the future of K-12 funding formulas is one that we expect to be engaged in and support the chair and the committee in considering how our K-12 funding allocations could be improved. At the same time, the governor has worked with the State Board of Education and the State Board of Higher Education on how to move performance funding into its formulas for funding community colleges and universities. The presidents of our community colleges, under leadership from our former commissioner, Cam Preuss, and our current CCWD head, Gerald Hamilton, the presidents of the community colleges have been pretty deeply engaged, pretty down in the weeds, actually, in how their funding formula from the state could be shifted in part to reflect their success at meeting certain key outcomes, critical outcomes for students. And there's, while the board has not yet adopted a change to the basic per student FTE formula that has been in operation for some years, that is very much under consideration by the State Board of Education. Likewise, the State Board of Higher Ed has for some time had a sort of rewards pot, if you will, that is available to universities partly on their basis of achieving, hitting key performance benchmarks, and that remains a topic that the governor will encourage both of these current boards, State Board of Ed and State Board of Higher Ed, as well as their successor board, the HEC, where these decisions will be made in the future about funding community, allocating funding to community colleges and universities. He'll be encouraging them to continue to work on that topic. Strategic grants, of course, should be very familiar. That form of outcomes-focused funding we did bring, the governor did bring to the legislature with recommendations around investing in teacher quality, investing in third-grade reading, investing in connections to guidance and support for post-secondary aspirations, and in connections to the world of work. And as Doug alluded, those recommendations, many of those recommendations were adopted by this legislature and sit alongside other targeted grant programs that the legislature over the years has established to create some focused funding for student success. So those are two sort of ways in which the topic is moving forward. It's a big topic, and I'm sure if Dr. Golden or members of the investment board were here, you'd get sort of a richer set of perspectives on the future of outcomes-based funding in Oregon. I'm prepared to address the post-secondary side of the question, but I'll pause and see if there are any
questions.
Questions, yeah.
I just have one, and I know it's a long time question, and with a whatever kind of answer. We have been talking for 6-8 years at least, probably, and Brian Reeder probably could tell us exactly, but looking at a statewide data system. And so that, I think the question that I have, I don't know about other members here in the education policy area and in finance, how are we going to measure these strategic initiatives that we, you know, put a lot of money into?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's a very good question, and I think the very simple answer is we'll measure their success based on the outcomes that they either help us achieve or not. And so it's true that both our existing data systems as well as what may be eventually created in a P20 sense that we're working on a business case for now will aid in our ability to measure the success of those key outcomes. But I don't... I think this legislature should expect that in 2015, the Education Investment Board or its representative or the governor, if we're asking for additional funding along the lines of strategic investments like ones we asked for and received in 2013, you should expect to see how those 2013 investments impacted student outcomes in the categories that we said that they would impact. The strategic plan that the investment board adopted is pretty clear about the targets that we have for student achievement. They're ambitious. The strategic investments are only a small portion of the way that we're going to need to get there, but you should expect to see some impact by 2015.
I won't make a comment. If you want to move on to post-secondary before I put my foot in my mouth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will save you from that. The post-secondary, so Hannah, I think, addressed the charge of this committee. I stepped out of the room, but as I understand it, you are required to identify whether we have quality goals established by law, and if so, then you determine whether the amount appropriated is sufficient to meet them or not, just as you do for K-12. In 2011, your report concluded essentially that while we've established 40-40-20, that doesn't constitute a quality goal. And as a result, you did not go on to attempt to determine whether we're appropriating a sufficient amount to meet it. I don't believe that the law has changed since 2011 in a way that would allow you to come to a different conclusion. I will comment that 40-40-20 remains kind of the overarching goal, not only for post-secondary, but for early education and K-12 as well, that it will clearly require a greater level of resource, as well as, you know, wiser deployment of those resources up and down the system. And that's very much true about post-secondary. The 2010 report that what came out of the Post-Secondary Quality Education Commission, with support from the National Center for Higher Education Management Systems, I think remains illustrative of some of the higher benefit, lower cost strategies that higher education can use to achieve 40-40-20. They're very much the kinds of things that this legislature has been talking about, including increasing dual credit, improving remedial or developmental education, identifying, recruiting students who have attended some college but not completed. We have a series of strategies in post-secondary that this report points to that we'll need to employ in order to help us move towards 40-40-20. We have a sense of which those lower cost strategies are, but to be clear, it will still take some additional resource.
Thank you. Comments? It's time to philosophize, Fred.
I might need another cookie.
thanks, Brent.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Okay, now for the people that really understand all this, Doug, if you and Brian could come and help us give us a snapshot of the quality education model. It's Doug Wells, not Doug Wilson.
The other Doug. Doug, too. I try to live up to his reputation. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doug Wells. I'm the chair of the Quality Education Commission and a parent of a Oregon public school student as well. Just real briefly, our commission is made up of citizens, superintendents, former teachers, business leaders, school board members, community college president, early education advocates, parents, and a former legislator who took the place of our good friend and mentor, Lynn Lundquist, who passed away this year. Thank you for inviting us here today. I'll just briefly go over what you, I'm sure, already know, that the task of the Quality Education Commission is to determine the amount of money sufficient to ensure that the state system of K-12 public education meets the goals established, identify best practices based on research, data, and judgment, and issue a report to the governor and the legislature around current practices, costs of continuing those practices, expected outcomes, best practices for meeting those goals, and the cost of implementing those practices. Some context in the last 2 years. Obviously, economic crisis has cut state and local revenue. And as well, under Governor Kitzhaber, we have, and the legislature, we have initiated a broad set of education reforms, including the creation of the OEIB and the Chief Education Officer, achievement compacts, strategic investments, regional early learning hubs, Common Core state standards, and integration at all levels of the P20 continuum. As you know, inflation-adjusted funding per student has been declining, and we continue to have a gap between K-12 funding and the quality education model, although I will add that it is a smaller gap than it has been in the past, which is a nice trend. So despite this long-term trend in declining funding, student achievement has shown improvement. Most recent test results are obviously reason for concern. We believe that for Oregon to meet its 40-40-20 education goals, we must have a more productive use of resources coupling with closing the funding gap. To that end, in preparing our work for their 2012 report, we formed two panels. One, a best practices panel, which was a statewide study of effective use of formative assessment and teacher collaboration. And second is a cost panel, which used a multi-year data set to follow cohorts of students and better determine how resource allocation influences student achievement. Brian will talk more about the cost part, and I'll briefly mention the best practices. We did a statewide survey of over 3,300 Oregon teachers representing more than 1,300 schools. And then we also followed that up by doing individual school interviews of matched pairs. And by matched pairs, I mean that we took ODE data and found comparison schools that were demographically similar but with very different outcomes. And we went on site and interviewed key leaders, teachers, administrators in the school and the district to find out what they were doing and what they weren't doing. So with that, I'll turn it over to Brian to talk about the cost panel.
Co-chair Comp, members of the committee, Brian Reeder with the Department of Education. Just briefly, as you know, the quality education model is a costing model that it really does two things. It estimates the level of funding that is required to meet the education goals that are established by law. And it also, in doing that, as part of that effort, it replicates sort of the current level of resources that we have for our schools to better understand how they're used and to get a sense for how much it would cost to do discrete policy programs, for example, class size reduction or adding professional development. Instead of saying, you know, the QEM is either all or nothing, it's a tool to understand the costs and impacts of specific policy proposals. And that, in my mind, is one of its great strengths. In terms of what the cost panel did in the last round for the commission, we looked at the patterns of allocation of resources within school districts. In other words, how do school districts allocate resources out to their individual school buildings to better understand how that influences student achievement in the context of student populations in those buildings. You know, stated more simply, do schools with greater needs, with students who have greater needs, get more resources from their district or not? And what we found was that some districts explicitly do give more resources to schools that have higher needs students, and some don't. You know, a great many districts allocate resources to school buildings based on formulas. For every 25 kids, they get a teacher, and for every X kids, they get a counselor, and so forth. There were no really strong conclusions from that analysis. What it suggested was that more resources in the middle grades would be beneficial. What we see is that if you reallocated dollars or added more dollars to the middle grades, it would get students to a higher level of achievement by the time they finish high school than if you added more resources either in grades 1 through 4 or 5 or in high school. We looked at performance and resource relationships over an entire 13-year cohort of students to try and understand those patterns. I think the lesson there, though, is that school districts really should pay attention to the specific needs in specific school buildings when they allocate resources, because they do vary substantially within school districts. Almost any school district, particularly large ones, you'll find great differences in the needs of students when you go from building to building, and districts should pay attention to that when they allocate resources if they want to serve their students well. So coming out of both the best practices panel work and the cost panel work, the QEC made a number of recommendations around teacher collaboration and formative assessments, and you can see those on page 5 of the handout. And then in terms of moving forward, one of the charges of the commission is to both to make two recommendations. First one on the best way to get Oregon to its academic goals for its students, and the second is to provide an alternative. And typically, the alternative that the commission has provided is a phased-in approach to funding the full extent of the QEM. And the reason that the commission has done that is because the funding gap, which is right now roughly $2 billion for the 13-15 biennium, really for two reasons. It doesn't make a lot of sense to dump that kind of money into the system all at one time. First of all, we don't have those kind of resources as a state. And second, it would be unlikely that districts could use those resources well if they received that many additional resources all at once. It would be like a family getting their income doubled overnight. Chances are you might waste a little bit of that money with a big party. So what we recommended is a phase-in of that $2 billion gap over a 10-year period. For 13-15, the recommended level for the state school fund was $6.85 billion, which is only slightly above where the legislature actually ended up. So that's good news. The good news is that you know, what the legislature did in the 13th session was consistent with that path to full funding of the QEM over a five biennia period. The challenge is to continue increasing that level of funding over the next four biennia at a rate that gets us along, further along that path. With that, we'll take any questions you have.
Thank you. Senator Hess.
Just really a philosophical question about the whole QEM, which was created and kind of invented by Lynn Lundquist, but it's been some years, and some of the methodology and architecture of the original QEM has changed. For example, ESDs, to use one of my favorite examples. We may not be doing ESDs in a couple of years. It may look altogether different and therefore hopefully cost a lot less, but the cost will be somewhere else. And I always wonder whether, and that I fear that some of the architecture in which the final figures are built have changed. And so and that would reflect in perhaps lower costs or maybe higher costs. And the new standards we're using, all of those things, you know, maybe that's reflective of higher costs. I know much of that is figured in, but every year we go through this, I get more and more concerned that we need to maybe rebuild the foundation and the architecture of the QEM, because I think it is useful. Just wondering what your thoughts were.
Let me just I'll mention one thing from a high level, and then I'll let Brian talk to the numbers. But we as a commission have taken a very proactive stance of following the governor's lead and your lead in looking at the P20 continuum, you know, even though our charge is specifically around K-12, but we believe that, you know, as Brian mentioned, the cost model, there's a lot of bang for the buck in the early years that aren't necessarily shown in, you know, in the current, some of the current thinking or the older thinking. I think Lynn was a big proponent of us thinking about this much more holistically, and we now have people on the commission who are focused on early education up through the college level. So we are adapting our thinking not to just providing you a number, but some thinking along, you know, collaborative thinking along with the OEIB and the governor's office around the best practices.
Yeah, I guess Senator Hass, what I would add to that is that, you know, the initial QEM was, you know, the architecture is, you know, it's a what we call a cost model, and it looks at the sort of the resources, and by resources, not dollars here, but teachers and administrators and counselors and the other people and supplies and energy and transportation, all those things that it takes to run schools well. That's where it starts. And then it puts prices on those things to make an estimate of what it costs to do that. And over the years, as we look at those resources that it takes to run a school, we've adapted what those look like and the amounts of those and the nature of those that it takes to run a school really well. I mean, an example would be, you know, the addition of a cost element for collaboration time. You know, as we learn more about how effective teacher collaboration is in assisting students, you know, we specifically called that out in the model. To your question related to ESDs, you know, the costs of ESDs are in the model, but there's not a great amount of detail in there about what ESDs do with that money. I mean, it's sort of treated as an administrative cost in some sense. That doesn't fully capture the level of services that ESDs provide to their districts, but what we learned is that the things that ESDs do for the districts varies tremendously around the state because of the needs of those districts, and we didn't find it really practical or even possible to model them the same way that we model the schools themselves. So as that changes, I mean, if we see a changing role for ESDs in some way, we will consider what that is and see if we can provide a greater level of detail and information about them that's more helpful. And then finally, back to one thing that Doug said, you know, even though our charge is specifically around K-12, the kids coming out of pre-K programs sort of flow into K-12, and so we've become increasingly interested in pre-K education programs and what they look like, how much they cost, and because the outputs or outcomes of the K-12 system are kids ready for either work or post-secondary education, we've also started looking more closely at community college and higher ed programs to try and integrate the whole thing. We really see great value in doing that, and the initial focus on K-12, I think, was too narrow,
yeah.
But it is written into the law, so we don't like to break the law, but when we have to, we do.
Madam Chair. Yes, Senator, please continue.
Another issue on that is dual credits and expanded options. We're spending more and more money on that end, and I think it's a great value and a great bang for the buck, and hopefully we'll be doing more of that as we continue. But that would effectively, I see a day where the 12th grade of K-12 is gone, and it's in the higher ed system. So therefore, that, you know, could reduce the QEM by 1/12, say, in a very rough way. But those are the things I and it sounds like, Brian, maybe you are those are integrated in there. But I just things are changing so quickly that I just getting back to the original. At what point is this model no longer relevant in a world where high school freshmen are earning college credits and others are going online and a charter school environment? I mean, how do you stay relevant with these cost figures?
Senator Haas, I think that the way we stay relevant is that we adapt the model over time to reflect the changing conditions out there. And I mean, we're doing that right now. We're building a pre-K component to the model that feeds in to the K-12 component. And we're actually working to, instead of using prototype schools as a methodology to generate these costs, the prototype schools assume student characteristics that are sort of the average for the state. And that's somewhat problematic because there's really no student out there who's average and there's no school that's average. So with all the student level data that we now have at the department, the model that we're contemplating would actually follow individual students through the system as they progress. And some of those students would take fewer years for high school and would start college either after their 11th grade in high school or midway through their senior year in high school, or they would earn dual credits while in high school. Some may stay a fifth year. We know that some students take longer. We're seeing more of that. But I think the answer is that the model can adapt. It has adapted to the changing conditions that we've seen in the last decade, and it will continue to adapt. But with the emphasis now on, much more emphasis on high school graduation and achieving 40-40-20, that opens a lot of doors or a lot of challenges for particularly high schoolers and that transition from high school into post-secondary. I think that's going to look a lot different in the next 10 years than it does right now, and we need to be able for the model to adapt to that.
I agree.
Yes. Senator Girard?
Just very quickly, I've sat on two or three of these now, and every time it's we're $3 billion, $2 billion, or underfunding schools, and I don't disagree, but that's just kind of the reality of where we're at. Have you done anything for looking at where we're going to get the $2 billion? And, you know, I think sometimes we have to think outside the box. We're a natural resource area. I come from an area that's very heavily timber-oriented. We've decimated the timber industry. You know, the first thing that's on our little page here is
timber tax revenues and whatever, a simple policy change at the federal government could alleviate a good chunk of that problem. And so we don't seem to be going off in that part of the arena at all. All we do is just say, hey, we're short $3 billion. And, you know, the assumption is that we can just go out there and tax $3 billion more, to, and the public's not going to allow us to do that. I just don't really think they will. So thinking outside the box, it seems to me, we have to look at where the solutions are. For me, the solution is federally a good timber policy that will generate the money so that we can put it in schools, because I do agree that they're underfunded.
I guess one thing that we haven't, part of what we do is not look at where to find money, to be honest. But what we have done is focused on providing more guidance to districts on how to use the money that they have more efficiently or to get better outcomes. So to focus on the revenue path through the K-12 system or starting even in early childhood and say, you know, we believe best practices point to focusing more investments on these particular objectives, which will use the money more efficiently that we have.
Just a quick question. I know our leadership is dealing with big issues, and many of us as members heard a report last night about how things are going and what are our balancing act between what we're going to be looking at in 2015. And what's been brought to my attention in the last couple of days, I was at a meeting this morning in Portland, and the school superintendent asked, he said, you know, what are you going to do when we can't fund all day kinder? He said, if we had to do that right now, it'd be an additional $2 million. It's just been processing in my mind, and so I don't know if you have any recent update or information, or if our leadership has asked for what is going to be the cost, potential cost for all-day kinder when that starts in 2015.
Chair Comp, I was asked to do that estimate a couple days ago.
Oh, okay.
For the biennium, if it were implemented in the 13-15 biennium, it's right around $144 million to provide or to pay for all-day kindergarten. Now, that's obviously some districts are doing it already, so that includes all the costs, not just the additional costs for those who aren't currently doing it. So it would take a little bit more effort to sort of net out the costs that some districts are already incurring to do full-day K. But just system-wide for the total cost of doing it are $144 million additional dollars per biennium.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
This note, I think we're digressing by getting on this, but...
Well, I think I agree, but...
I always get frustrated on the cost of full-day kindergarten. For one thing, you can't just do it in a vacuum. Several years in the 2011 session, we slashed the cost of ESDs, cut out administrative costs, and part of the reason we did that was to finance full-day kindergarten. So you've got to take factors in like that. And second, you can't just take full-day kindergarten and double 0.5 to 1.0 and think that that's a fair trajectory. Not saying that you're doing this, Brian, but there are all kinds of built-in costs by the fact that so much of the educational infrastructure already exists. So it's not a doubling of costs. And when we were working on this a few years ago, what people found was it's not twice as much. It might be 10 or 20% more because you've still got, you know, full-time administrators and buildings and heat and utility that aren't going to double in costs. And so that, in addition to the extra $1 billion we put into K-12 this past year, it just seems like it's crazy now all of a sudden to say that in 2015 we'll have this new expenditure. It's just I don't think it's a valid expression of a cost figure. And if some people want to do that for reasons that I can't quite identify, then that's fine. But I think you've got to point out there's some other realities that are in place here.
Saves money down the road.
Yeah. Well, in addition, the long-term savings right. are pretty well researched and documented.
Well, and Senator Hash, thank you, because I know that you have done a tremendous amount of work on that subject. And when I didn't have, I am using committee time to get a better answer when people are asking me that question. So thank you for your response. And, because I know that it's well thought out policy, there's purpose for it, and yet in tight budget times, it just seems like people kind of are tense about a lot of different things. And, well, it's like, well, you guys are mandating it. You better be paying for it.
Well, can I?
Madam, please.
We're going down this alley here.
Yeah, I know. I shouldn't have done it.
But I have a unique perspective in that I have a son in kindergarten now. And we have a high school girl. And I remember her half-day kindergartens in the Beaverton School District. When she was in a half day, which really wasn't a half day, it was about 2 hours, and it was carpet squares and sing-alongs, and this was 10 or 11 years ago. It's part of what inspired me to start working on full day. The other day when we started with Sam in kindergarten, it's full day, we're paying for the extra half, but the agenda includes sentence structure, math.
It's huge.
And it's like real school. And he and his classmates will be ready for first grade in a way that my daughter's team was not ready. And those kids are going to be much more successful. They're going to be easier to teach. And teachers tell me when kids are easier to teach, they're cheaper to teach. And I just don't know how you quantify those kind of savings. But people have done this, and there's research on the benefits of full day versus half day that, you know, that you can cite until the cows come home. But so I just hope that, again, people are careful when they're looking at these costs to look at both ends of the equation.
Thank you. I'm sure Sam's going to do great.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is amazing what our youngsters are learning at this. I mean, it's revolutionary. It's pretty neat. Any last thoughts? Okay, because we're going to wrap this thing up here and go to lunch. So, Victoria, what do I need to do?
Well, Madam Chair, we need to talk about where the committee would like to go from here. Historically, we have had staff go ahead and draft the report based on the numbers submitted by the Quality Education Commission and LFO. That would be distributed for comments to the committee, and then we would come back in November, recap the process, review the report, have it open for public testimony, and then the committee would approve it.
For adoption.
Right, for adoption. If that is the committee's wish, we can go ahead with that again this year. Otherwise, it's up to you.
I think that system is a good system. I mean, we had good information today, good updates, and unless I hear anybody that thinks we ought to do it differently, are we okay with the quote-unquote status quo or the you know, standard operating procedure here today? Okay, thank you. We will do that, Victoria, if you would be so gracious and work through doing the notes and getting them to us, and so that during our committee days in November, we can take final action. And lots will happen in between these times, but I want to thank you for your work. I want to thank for everybody that did reports and did presentations. So colleagues, members, we're adjourned.